Welcome to Jawa Jabber, a Star Wars podcast dedicated to spreading our own little slice of positivity throughout the galaxy. From the prequels to the sequels to every Disney Plus spinoff they want to throw at us, we're here to celebrate any time we get to spend in our favorite galaxy together, and we want you to come along for the ride. I'm David Wren, joined by my bro hosts Dennis, Kyle, and Matt. We invite you to sit back, relax, and enjoy our fully armed and operational podcast.
And this is Jawa Jabber.
Hello there, Star Wars fans, and welcome to another all-new episode of Jawa Jabber. I am your co-host and supreme leader, David Wren. The gang's all here tonight. We've got Dennis the Phantom Menace.
Dello, Felagets. I would like to propose my first order to say, long live the New Republic.
We've got Matt the radar technician.
I'm Matt. I'm the really shredded radar tech here to talk with my favorite folks.
And of course, Kynobi.
Your friend's a liar, man. Matt's a punk bitch.
Oh my gosh. I love you guys.
Soaking wet
so
under
much.
That dress of his. No, just kidding.
All right. So, Kyle, want to lead us off tonight and tell us what we're going to be talking about?
Absolutely. So, chapter 19, The Convert, was directed by Lee Isaac Chung, most famously known for directing Minari, starring Steven Yeun, which is actually nominated for 2 Oscars in 2020. The episode was written by Noah Clore, who worked on The Book of Boba Fett, and Jon Favreau, of course. And the director of photography was Dean Cundey, who is most famously known for being a cinematographer on Apollo 13, directed by none other than Ron Howard, and Jurassic Park, along with dozens of other films.
Awesome. So what did you guys think of this episode? Like, I know it's a bit of a departure. Well, it's kind of a bit of a departure. I mean, it starts off exactly where we left off last week, emerging of the Mythosaur and everything, but then it really cuts to, well, I mean, Kyle, you predicted it last week. You said, oh, hey, next week we're going to go to Coruscant. And I mean, you were right. It really, in pacing and stuff, it's definitely a departure. It felt very Andor to me.
100% agree.
Yeah, it works for me. My view of the episode now has changed a lot from the moment I watched it. I guess the episode was not what I was expecting at all. And that's not that it's a bad thing. It's just the middle section still plays really slow. And it was intended to be something like Andor without the quality of the dialogue. And to me, that kind of showed that the campiness, and I mean that in the most loving way possible, of Mando and the serious, darker tone of Andor don't really mix. But overall, I liked the episode a lot. The opening and the ending were both really solid. Again, my viewpoint from the time we watched it this morning has really changed on the middle section. It's just, I guess, the clash of the tones is the biggest issue for me. Not that I don't love Dr. Pershing or where they're going with that story.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. The clash of tones is definitely something in this episode. Again, not necessarily a negative reaction for me. Just, it was definitely different. I mean, the graphics in those dogfights are phenomenal. And I thought Coruscant looked beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful as ever.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And, oh, my God, the Opera House. They went to the Opera House. Like, I was just looking for Palpatine to be in there somewhere and talking to Anakin. I knew that it wasn't going to happen. I just thought that was a really cool callback. I would have liked to have seen the Jedi Temple somewhere. You know, we saw the Opera House. Couldn't we have seen what happened to the Jedi Temple?
Well, I don't think we're done with Coruscant. So
no, not at all. I don't think we're done with it either. Matt, what did you think about the episode? I know we talked a little bit about it this morning.
Yeah, so I mean, I watched it one full time with you, and then I watched it kind of off and on while I was getting ready after that with my son. Obviously, the beginning of the episode was awesome. You know, it was fast paced. The dogfight was pretty sweet. I don't know, you know, if you love Star Wars, I don't know how you don't like the whole opening sequence of the episode. I thought it was for it being the longest episode, I think, that we've gotten, it was definitely different for me. It almost felt Like, it was good and I enjoyed it, but it definitely felt like it's going to be like almost what you consider a filler episode for the season. But it was different from like the filler episodes of season one and two, in that it actually advanced the story a lot more than like your typical filler episode, I guess, would, you know, like it really, the plot was evolved quite a bit. It developed, you know, the second storyline with Dr. Pershing. And, you know, there's a lot of the episode I really did like. I think specifically John had talked about in interviews that they were going to start kind of referencing some of the sequel, like there's going to be some sequel trilogy tie-ins, you know, because this is kind of leading up to the First Order. So you're obviously seeing that possibly some with the Empire and the cloning, which heard it the first time, and it took me until the second time watching the episode to hear it. But when they're standing there at the mountain, and you could hear that Rise of the Resistance theme playing, like,
yeah,
you know, it was slightly changed, and it was like more, great. It was more of a harmony, yeah. You know,
right. But it was in a different key.
Yep. Which and it
is
it
took, is actually what they did on Rebels when for Empire Day, that episode with Empire Day, and they did like the parade, they did the Imperial March, and it was in like a higher key, which made it sound more joyous, more.
And it broke, you know, broke the third or the, I don't know if it's a third or the fourth wall, but it like, it cemented that as canon, even though that was created by, you know, John Williams, which is real life. So I thought that, yeah, I totally, totally agree with that. And that was really cool to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we're going to see a little bit more and more of that. And, you know, it did take a second to realize that was what I was hearing. I had to think for a moment, like, what song? I know this song. What song is it? I know it's from the sequel trilogy. But I think the thing that I found, like, you know, like I told David, I kind of got lulled, I think, a little bit as that mission to the Star Destroyer went on. And then it did eventually pick up for me where I found it more enjoyable. But I did find it interesting, the whole just base of the story with what they're doing with Pershing and like the assimilation back in like into the amnesty program into the New Republic. And I feel like they're kind of doing the whole gray area thing again, where they're showing the New Republic in a certain light. And yeah, because, you know, the original trilogy was so black and white, whereas George with the prequels went more and more of a not everything's black and white direction, like, you know, stuff is a lot more complicated, without getting too deep into that yet. But I feel like they're kind of painting and showing the New Republic like a little glimpse of that, and they're kind of starting to not dive in but kind of probe that idea of, you know, like the Empire was this one thing, it was, you know, considered bad, but then maybe not everybody thought it was, you know, 100% bad, because people are brainwashed, or, you know, just people think differently depending on where they are. And then like the New Republic kind of people are, you know, gonna think the same thing just to based on who they are and where they are. So I found the dynamics of the way they're starting to talk about and show the New Republic to be pretty interesting, and I'm kind of curious how much and where they're gonna go with that going forward.
I thought it was really interesting because, like, yeah, like you were mentioning that gray area, and when the whole thing with Pershing toward the end with the brainwashing or the brain wiping or whatever you want to call it, like, the thing that stood out in my brain was Kylo talking to General Hux about the, like, the conditioning and how, you know, the stormtroopers were taken from their villages and whatever, and they were brainwashed, and they were like, it's, to me, it sounds a lot like the same technology.
Yeah. So reconditioning.
Like,
yeah.
Right. Like the, right. Yeah. Like the conditioning and the, like, so if they're going to take these Imperial people and condition them to be air quote good guys, how good are they? Like,
and I
don't know. That- it gets very black and white, or not black and white. It gets very gray, like, right. And it's very interesting. I don't know. I found it very, very interesting.
Well, I found it very interesting that, you know, as he's laying there and he's looking at it and he's saying that, well, this is a mind, what do you call the mind flayer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine something that's really going to mess with your brain, you know, and they're looking at it and they're like, oh no, this is going to help you, you know? And then obviously as Katie O'Brien's character is turning the dial on it. It's like changing the intensity of it or something.
Right, like she turns it up even more.
Right. So, you know, one side views it as, okay, we're going to use it to this extreme and it's helping you, but then it's also obviously some torture or huge, like, life-changing device that can be used for bad. Like, it's all, you know, a certain point of view, I guess.
One thing I liked that this episode did well is that when they showed Pershing working in his everyday day job, just like Cyril was in Andor, one is taking place under the tyranny of the Empire and the other is taking place during the rule of the New Republic. But for the average person, it's just the same day, same thing, different day.
It's just work, yeah.
It's just work. Everybody's lives are pretty much exactly the same for the most part in these core worlds. And I thought that was a really nice parallel between these two shows.
In the Opera House, where there was one of those, like, I don't know, highfalutin, rich people who was saying, you know, New Republic, Rebellion, Empire, I can't keep track of it anymore. So that kind of goes with what you're saying. This, for most people, it doesn't matter who's really in charge, because the majority of people who live in this universe aren't really privy as to what's actually happening. They're just living their normal lives.
Exactly.
And that's crazy to me, just because, you know, like, you see how it affects all those other planets, and I'm not just talking about, like, Alderaan and, like, you know, the planets that are destroyed and whatnot. I don't know, it blows my mind. But Matt, I do agree with what you said about the lull there, kind of like on the train. I feel like that when that droid officer was gonna check the tickets or whatever, like, that whole scene could have been cut down a little bit.
I think a lot of those police officers might be a bit of an Easter egg from both Clone Wars and Rebels, especially the last season of Clone Wars, with Trace and Rafa, where there's those kind of police robot officers that are patrolling Coruscant and making sure that everything is, you know, under law and order, separate from the humans that are actually the officers of the New Republic. So I think that was kind of when I first saw them, I'm like, hey, they look really familiar. I mean, they're not wearing hats like police officers in the animated series, but they're pretty much the same kind of deal.
So what were you going to mention? You said you had a lot to talk about. Like, what were
I
you
do,
gonna...
And I'll get into it a little bit more as we talk some more in this episode. But I actually really enjoyed this. I think I enjoyed it more on my second viewing. I hadn't finished it yet before the podcast episode. But I was pretty much towards the end and I started to pick up on a lot more things that I missed. But overall for the episode, I agree with what both Kyle and Matt said, and that there is that lull in the middle of the episode where at the beginning we have a lot of stuff going on with Mando and Bo-Katan, and then we come back to them at the end of the episode. But in the middle, it would definitely change course, and that we're exploring a different part of the storyline, and whether some people think maybe that should have been a completely different series or a part of The Mandalorian season 3, you know, that's up for debate. And I think that also kind of feeds into what Matt was saying. It's all kind of a certain point of view, right? And that's really unique to Star Wars, in that a lot of people can have opinions. They can have different ideas as to what they'd like to see in series such as this. But also going back to what Matt said about the gray areas that George developed in the prequels, and then I think also kind of continued in the sequels, is that in this specific situation, it really allows people to see things from different perspectives, because a lot of people think, you know, well, we've always been conditioned Empire bad, Rebellion good, right? Well, now it's like, it depends on what side you were on and how you viewed things. And it really helps to expand people's minds as to, you know, other people's viewpoints and other people's how they kind of see the world. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to say it's all gray and nobody's good and nobody's bad. It just means that it allows you to expand your horizons to understand that not everybody has the same mindset. Not everybody has the same kind of viewpoint, where if you don't fit into this box or into this category, then you're wrong. And I think that allows viewers at least see that it's not as clear cut or as black and white, as you said, David, as many people would like it to be, just depending on what part you were. And even that amnesty program that Matt talked about, that was a large part of this episode, was people saying, like, for example, Dr. Pershing's speech was describing how he was working under the Empire, not everybody had a choice. initially, if we go back to Clone Wars or we go back to the prequels, this was a part of, this wasn't the Empire, this was the Republic, right? So that transitioned to the Empire, but a lot of people still stayed with it because they thought they were on the right side, or they thought this was what was correct and they were doing the right thing. And I really like that they're expanding on that in the live action portions of this too, on these Disney Plus series, because it allows, like I said, people to kind of see it with a much broader perspective than just, you know, it's just this, this is how it is and this is how it always is going to be. I really enjoyed the episode. I personally would give it a 7 out of 10. A lot of good action sequences. I love the beginning and I love the end. But I also like that middle portion where, as Kyle and I think all of us agree, it's very Andor vibes like, and I think they tried to push that in, and it did seem kind of clunky, kind of shoehorned in. But at the same time, I kind of like the little bit of a break of a develop the storyline, move the story forward without it constantly being action scenes or always Mando. And I thought it was really funny, and I'll end it on this until we move on to some other things, that I saw a meme, right? Whereas this guy's rubbing his hands, I'm sure you've seen it. He's standing behind a tree looking for his opportunity, right? And it's like, this is Boba Fett looking at this going, I think maybe I could sneak my way into one of these Mando episodes if they're going to put in this kind of stuff. You know? And it's like, maybe in the next couple episodes, who knows? We'll see Boba.
We better see Boba.
That brought up a good point. That I didn't think about. If you go back and watch Andor, there are plenty of episodes where he doesn't show up for a solid 20 or 30 minutes, I guarantee it. They right. focus on Mon Mothma and other parts, but nobody complained then, you know what I mean? But now all of a sudden on Twitter and such, it's a big deal that Mando wasn't in his own show for 30 minutes. Dave and Matt, we were talking this morning about it. I was not super keen on the episode in that middle section, but the more I thought about it, what I would have wanted is cutting back and forth. That way we're not going so long without seeing
good point.
Characters. But again, those tones don't match. So if you're cutting back and forth between Dr. Right. Pershing going, oh, slave biscuits, and then you're going to Mando and Bo-Katan talking about their client, like it doesn't mix well. So sandwiching in the Pershing arc makes sense, and it's just the best you can do with the circumstances.
I do like that they gave Pershing like kind of a block of time to really, so you could really focus on him, because you don't really know what's been going on with him or Gideon or really the antagonists of the show. And obviously Gideon was mentioned early that he had possibly escaped from before he got to the War Tribunal. So I feel like, you know, a lot of this episode is really building what is going on with the antagonists of the story. Because if they didn't show him at all in this episode, then we would have gone 3 episodes with pretty much zero backstory, now like anything going on with the antagonists. And then all of a sudden they're just going to show up like 4 or 5 episodes in. I'm glad they have started this part of the story, so that way it's going to build and crescendo into something with Moff Gideon, hopefully here in another episode or two. The TIE fighters, you know, that attacked them in the beginning, they definitely, obviously that's related, but they're being coy about, there's a reason why they didn't show where they came from. They didn't show the ship they came from.
Yeah, so maybe he did escape and he's the one that's going after them anyway.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see episode 4 next week of a little teaser about the Moff.
Next week's episode, we're at the halfway point already.
There's only
8 episodes. It's insane. I feel like it just started.
Let me just throw this in because I think Kyle mentioned it. The Empire travel biscuits, that whole thing. I thought that was kind of funny because I actually, I have these things called, and it's not the cheese. So it's Belvita, not Velveeta.
Okay.
These are morning biscuits. I don't know if you guys have seen it. You kind of dip it into your coffee or something and they get softer, but normally they're super dry and not very pleasant to eat, but they provide you a lot of energy and kind of sustained energy so that you can stay, you know, okay until lunchtime without having to eat a huge breakfast, which I just don't ever have the opportunity to do. But I thought that was kind of interesting with those biscuits, because I'm just like, huh, that's kind of what I have in the morning. I mean, they're not Empire endorsed, but yeah, that was an interesting little dialogue there that they had between, oh, I like the yellow ones or I like the red ones or whatever. And that whole thing, I don't know, just reminded me of like how my mornings usually go. And maybe I'm somewhat connected to what they used to eat. I don't know. But it's a ration thing. So maybe I'm just not eating enough for breakfast. I don't know.
It just felt very real world between that biscuit talk. And I know that we're in our favorite galaxy far, far away, but like the whole amnesty thing, I mean, that actually happened in our world. You know what I mean? Like, it just, you know, I just love how they make it so relatable, even though none of us have been through a war. None of us, you know what I mean? Like, it just, I don't know. It blows my mind. I think it's fantastic. Like, it's not all lightsabers and
no,
Jedi.
I love the integration. The integration of it's great. And while we're on the topic of biscuits, those drinks that they were having, all right? What were those drinks? Were there? Do you guys know what buzz balls are? You ever heard of buzz balls?
No,
unfortunately, yes. I have heard of it. Yes,
Kyle. All right, Kyle's heard, and Matt. All right, so that's what I thought of. And I'm like, did they just have like the Star Wars version of buzz balls stacked up on top of each other? David, if you don't know what it is, it's essentially like a small, what it looks to be almost like a ball of alcohol that you can open. You can get at a gas station. You can get wherever you want. And it's got like 8 or I think it might be 10% alcohol. And it's a wine that has some kind of flavor in it. So you could have like lime, or you could have like a coffee version, or there's all sorts of different kinds. And that's what it looked like to me. But on the same coin, which I guess is a weird coin if you think about it, y'all have seen The Lost World, right? The second movie of the Jurassic Park trilogy, right?
Like some that came ago. Out before Kyle? Warren, yes.
Every time, man. David, you got that on point. Every time you mentioned it in the episode, Kyle is so young. No, just kidding.
Every time.
So there's this scene where there's this kid and he's lost on this island, and his parents hire like the main characters to come and try, and like they trick them to try to get them over on the island and find their son that's missing. Well, this guy is in this abandoned truck, which has a bunch of different supplies in it. And it's got this flask of what looks to be lemonade, but he says it's a T-Rex pee and it attracts a really big dinosaur. And when I saw those buzz balls on that table in the amnesty housing, I thought, buzz balls or T-Rex pee? I don't know.
That sounds disgusting.
Hey, it might be a delicacy on Coruscant. Yeah, exactly. Or it's a Zillow Beast pee.
So I gotta ask, and I was talking to David about this earlier, if anyone else had this thought, and maybe some of our listeners did too, but I was never one big on shipping Rey and Ben Solo in the sequel trilogy.
I know where you're going.
Seeing Bo-Katan and Din's chemistry, I am all on board with those two getting together. I think they should make Bo-Din babies.
So in that case, do they keep their helmets on while they're doing the nasty? What's happening?
Jesus Christ.
I mean, come on. This is the way, right?
My God, you went there. Christ.
We're totally losing all 8 cents out of our new we had built up for this episode.
Yeah, right? Like, I'm going to have to change the clean rating on our podcast now. Like,
hey, there's no swears.
It's still PG, PG-13-ish.
It's still PG-13.
I didn't say the word. True. I mean, we could use all sorts of euphemisms for it, but we're all thinking it. Come on.
Okay, you guys are. I'm not. I mean, I see the chemistry, yes. I understand what you guys are saying. There's definitely chemistry, and Dennis will vouch for me. I was not a Ben Solo Rey supporter till after The Last Jedi. Like, in Force Awakens, there's all those... And listeners, if you're some of them, I apologize that, like, you know, when he kidnapped her in Force Awakens, they were like, oh, my God, they're meant to be together and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, no, I'm like, no, you guys are insane. That's not happening. Like, there's no way. But then once they like connected in The Last Jedi and whatever, yes, I was feeling that way. Now, just the close ups of Bo in this episode, like while the armorer was talking and stuff, I still think she's gonna not necessarily betray them, but like she's just using Din to kind of get back to Mandalore and get the Mythosaur. And like, not necessarily as a villain, but like, I think she's just kind of using him to service her own needs. And no, I'm not talking about that. That, Matt.
Let's talk about that.
I hadn't thought of that.
Let's unravel that thread though, because there's two schools of thought on this, I think. The first one is she wants to deny what she saw. That's why she asked Mando. And then at the end, when she sees a Mythosaur skull cast, she's like, it's definitely what I saw, and I'm not crazy. Or she knew what she saw from the beginning, wanted to verify that Mando didn't see it. That way, she goes down there, she tames the thing somehow, and she's the rightful ruler of Mandalore.
See, that's where I think they're going. I think they're going that way, because then if she does the Mythosaur, she doesn't have to have the Darksaber, and then Din can keep the Darksaber.
I can definitely see both ways of thinking, and I'm not going to say either one is right or wrong, because they're both very logical. Her having the thought that, okay, I'm going to go back by myself and tame this beast myself, you know, I would kind of wonder if she... I know she's brave and bold, but that is like near crazy bold. Would she actually think she could do it all by herself? And I'm not saying she can't. Well, no, I don't even think Mando.
I think they're all gonna go back to Mandalore, because they're gonna be like, "Hey, the planet's fine. Let's go back and let's try and, you know, you've got all these little Mandos, including, you know, Jimmy Kimmel's nephew or whatever." So, like, why don't we, like, get back to Mandalore and we start rebuilding the city? And
like, it's not cursed anymore, or all the myths about it, right? But, like, I kind of agree with Matt. I'm kind of going to have a conflict here with, I guess, maybe you, David, and Kyle, where, I mean, I can see that happening. If it happened, I wouldn't be upset at all with Bo-Katan taming the Mythosaur. But, like, it's hard to tell what their intentions are, because, one, they both have helmets on. So they're trying to convey the emotions as best as they can through a helmet. But it's really hard when you can't read their face. And what particularly got me, and might have this been for you as well, Matt, is when they were on Bo-Katan's ship at the beginning, towards the beginning of the episode, and he said, "This is the way." She said, "This is the way." And then they looked back at each other, and Grogu made this sound, and it was like, they had a moment. Like, I don't know what they were thinking in their minds until the TIE interceptors show up, you know? And that's where I was kind of like, what is she like doing? You know, what's with that look she gave them?
No, I was going to say, like, I still think she thinks that they're a cult. Like, they're a crazy Mandalorian cult.
But now she's alone. She doesn't have her home. It was blown up by the remnants of the Empire. And I think she's pissed about that. So, like, I feel like the other Mandalorians would join her in fighting.
I feel she's
going to rally them to her cause, not necessarily the way.
I think she's definitely feeling alone, but I think she's definitely skeptical. Like, she does think they're crazy for sure and over the top. So I think she's very, I think you could kind of see it at the end when she, you know, they told her, you are redeemed also, and now you are a part of us. It looked like she was kind of uncomfortable, possibly, which, like,
I feel like in her head she was like, oh great, thanks, I'm so glad that I'm redeemed, you know what I mean? Like that wasn't her intention. She was just trying to save him,
which, like, and Dennis said, it's hard to tell with their helmets on, you know, they're trying to convey these things, but it's actually kind of the cool part of it too, is it leaves you to wonder and guess really what they're feeling, because you can't see it on their face. But I think you could definitely clearly see some chemistry and respect, I think, between Bo and Din.
At the very least.
You know, she came and saved him twice, actually, at the last episode. And now he saved her, really, in this episode. Like, they are clearly connected and want to help each other. Like, they are saving each other's butt. You can see that chemistry going. I mean, not a huge thing, but I think it's definitely something. And
I really hope she doesn't betray him. I hope she doesn't, like, do something where it's like, oh, he's like, I shouldn't have put my trust in you. But, like, I totally see what you guys are coming from. Like, maybe she just thinks, this is a crazy cult. I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm here because I got nowhere else to go. Din Djarin brought his little tube of holy water, And he's like, here, I was in the mines. Here we go. And she pours it in. It's like, oh, look, it's making all these cool colors in my vat of water. He definitely did it. Like, I can totally see that. And it just kind of, she wanted to leave the mines, but then she kind of gave that look back as like, did I actually see what I thought I saw? Am I losing my mind? Kind of like Kyle said, where she saw that mythosaur skull of Beskar. And she's like, that's reminding me of what I saw. So it's really interesting to see where they take this. And I really like that we'd have no idea. And we're just going into it, like, not really quite sure what's going to happen. We have our theories, we have our speculations, but at the end of it, whatever happens, I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
And let's be honest, Grogu is like the ultimate lady getter.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, Bo-Katan's not going to want to betray Din when he's got Grogu at his side. Like, he's got probably all the ladies knocking on his door.
If Grogu hadn't have gone back to get Bo-Katan, yeah, she'd still be sitting there. She'd be dead because she'd be in the palace when the TIE bombers...
Her whole demeanor... Her whole, like, attitude changed when Grogu showed up in the N1 Starfighter. She's like, what happened to him? And it's like, it wasn't more of like, get off, hell off my planet. It was like, tell me where he is. Yeah, exactly. What happened to Daddy? You think if the armorer, like, threw some of that, and I, you know, affectionately call it holy water, if she threw some of that on somebody and they're like, weren't a part of their cult, they would start like sizzling and burning because they're like not the way, they're not a part of, I don't know. I'm getting into Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire stuff.
Yeah, have you been watching Buffy or something?
Like... I've been watching Supernatural a lot. And can we all agree that whole, the transfer between her ship and him diving down out of her ship to get to his ship on the platform, that was an awesome scene.
Yeah. That was amazing. Like Kyle said before, like, the budget that they're spending on this is so worth it. Like, it just looks so good.
That was beautifully directed. And it looked a lot like Octo.
Yeah, didn't it? When he was going down, it totally looked like that. I agree. I kind of thought that. I was like,
David's like, waiting for the porgs to fly around.
Know what? I was going to say, we got our Anzellians in the other episode. I want a porg. I want a porg somewhere, whether it's in a marketplace. I don't care if a Wookiee is riding by with like a cooked porg that he's eating or something. I don't care, as long as it's a porg.
I mentioned in the group chat, and this is going to be the word of the day for everybody listening, Ecumenopolis apparently is what Coruscant is, because the whole planet is made of cities and skyscrapers. Didn't know that word until I heard that, and Dr. Pershing was listening to his Cliff Notes or Audible or whatever they have on that planet.
Yeah, Favreau has a way of putting words in each episode, I feel like, just stick with you, that you've never heard of before.
Because yeah, remember in the Phantom Menace, all they said was, you know, the whole planet is one big city.
Yeah, and but all the expanded universe stuff, I don't ever remember seeing that word used in talking about Coruscant.
But I did want to mention a couple things, if you don't mind, David. I will stop talking for a little bit if anyone else has some things before we get to the end of the episode. But the Coruscant, I call it the Coruscant County Fair, all right? Where we went to go see all these lovely things and magic acts and, you know, all of that. It kind of looked like a town square. Did you guys notice, because Matt mentioned it before, where the music that was playing was very was from the sequels, and it was The Rise of the Resistance. That's the name of the track. Did you notice the buildings that were in that town square? Anybody notice anything interesting? The buildings, those cone-shaped buildings, you might have to watch it again. I was like, I have seen that somewhere. And I thought, Ralph McQuarrie. So I looked it up, and Ralph McQuarrie's concept art for Coruscant has those cone-shaped lit buildings. If you look it up, look it up on Google. Yeah, they included that in there. And I'm quite proud of myself that I didn't find this Easter egg by watching a YouTube video where somebody described all the Easter eggs for me. So I was like, that's pretty cool that they included that in there. And then, of course, that music from Rise of the Resistance, which, again, linked to The Last Jedi and the sequels. And it's just for all those people who hate the sequels, which is not any of us. I'm sorry, but they are leading to that, and they directly connect with this series. So It's not going to be erased. Bob Iger is back. That's great, but it's not going to be somehow, like I said, erased or you know, they're going to redo the sequels or some other baloney that they have on the internet these days.
But no, Disney is going to retcon the sequels. That's what they're paying Jon Favreau to do.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you, David. Retcon just did not hit my head.
All right.
You mentioned the Opera House, right? The Opera House there.
Yeah.
Where Dr. Pershing made his speech. I was like, hey, this looks similar. I was looking for Papa Noida and Mr. George Lucas walking around in his blue skin. I didn't see that. But
is he still alive? In this time frame?
Probably not. I would have to assume probably not, but he wasn't there from what I could tell. But I like that whole speech, actually, and I don't know if you guys caught this, but he started talking about a lot of the genetic aspects of the cloning and the Kaminoans, and they had this whole hologram, right, where they showed the DNA strands, and he said that he took the best, or they were trying to take the best genetic attributes of both donors to make it into something that, you know, was ideal. And that really struck a chord with me. And this was the second time watching it, because the first time I didn't catch this, but the second time I was like, wait a second. This is also connecting to the sequels, because what did Palpatine want to do? He wanted a host body that was not only force sensitive, but was also a way in which he could inhabit that body, right? And I'm thinking Rey's parentage and that connection, because that was also a part of the sequels, where who was the son, who was Rey's actual father? Well, it was a discarded clone, or not a clone, but necessarily, if you read the actual the novelization of The Rise of Skywalker, it was somebody that Palpatine rejected because he didn't have force abilities. And he thought, you know,
strand cast or something?
Yes, like the first, yeah, they rejected it, right? And this is, I think this is really setting up that whole thing of the cloning, the return of the Sith Eternal with Palpatine and inhabiting a clone body. And then there's Rey, of course, who was the product of something similar to this. And then Grogu may be involved as well with his blood and the whole scientific cloning experiment stuff. I really enjoyed, just because of my background in biology and in science. I think this is a really cool setup. I can't wait to see where they go with it.
I agree with Dennis. How much they're going to directly go into the sequel trilogy, you know, I don't know. And I don't, you know, no one, I guess, knows until it happens, but I think they're definitely going to tie to it and reference it and make connections to it. And I actually kind of went down this rabbit hole of thinking earlier, and so I'll try to make it quick, but I was thinking about how they, like I was talking earlier about how they're showing things in kind of a gray light with the government. A lot of it is just in the eye of the beholder. What I was thinking of, though, is like just in terms of like a lot of the leadership, like, and it made me think of the Bloodline novel, which is a novel that is canon. So it's in the new canon, and it takes place like 6 years before The Force Awakens, and it has to do with Leia and the Bloodline, like the Anakin Skywalker, Leia Luke Bloodline. And the basis of the novel is that I've really found interesting is, you know, a lot of people think when Anakin is redeemed at the end of Return of the Jedi, that just possibly everybody thought, oh, everything is great with him. You know, like Anakin's redeemed, like we all think he's great again. Darth Vader, you know, is, they don't really think about the fact that, you know, the whole galaxy doesn't know that Anakin was Darth Vader. Very few people knew that. Darth Vader was known, you know, as this terrible, like almost like a Hitler probably. And so when he's redeemed and dies, nobody knows this. And nobody knows that Leia and Luke are Darth Vader's children. They might have known that they were Anakin's children, but they don't know Anakin was Darth Vader. So that knowledge is hidden for a long time, all the way through the New Republic, you know, building up, and Leia is involved in the government. And Mon Mothma is the chancellor for a long time. And then when Mon Mothma is getting ready to step down and step away, Leia is, you know, considered as to be one of the front runners to become the chancellor. But because, you know, the government, just like, you know, the New Republic and just like the Empire and just like the Old Republic, not everybody is good. Everybody has their own interests. Some people are pure evil in it. You know, there's just a very broad range of who's involved, what their, you know, motivations are. So somebody leaks that Leia was Darth Vader's daughter, and that's how it's leaked. She is Darth Vader's daughter, and it basically torpedoes her political career. She has to, she leaves the Senate.
I imagine it would.
So, yeah. You know, that's what leads her to go have to basically form the resistance, because she has no power, you know, no standing in the government anymore, because no one trusts her.
Oh, that makes sense. So, I really should read that book. That's a good
one. Yeah, so, see, I mean,
it's a fascinating story.
I never read
story.
That book. Right.
Yeah, and it kind of, it talks a lot about, you know, the grayness of the New Republic and the government, and that maybe, you know, where we're so used to, those of us that grew up with the original trilogy, we're so used to everything being black and white, you know, Jedi, Sith, good, bad, you know, Empire, bad, Rebels, good. Whereas as we've moved on past that, everything has become way more gray. And I liked what this episode did with that. And it made me start thinking about all the things I've read in the new canon that kind of play along with that whole idea, I guess.
Yeah, see, I never read that book, but just from the little bits and pieces that I got from the sequel trilogy, like, to me, just the fact that Leia had to make a resistance made me think that the New Republic wasn't all that great. You know what I mean? Like, yes, they were the supposed good guys.
That's a good point. No, that's a good point, because I think that's also what they're setting up, and what Matt and Kyle and all of us were talking about, is that it really depends on your point of view. It depends on, you know, which quote unquote side you're on, and who you think is actually doing the best for the galaxy, for the people that you love and the people who are around you. But yeah, what about Kyle? We want to hear what are your thoughts? Do you have anything to bounce off of us, or anything you want to mention about what we're talking about?
But no, I do like what Matt was talking about, how we all grew up with the Star Wars that was very black and white, and that, you know, the Rebels are the good guys and the Empire is the bad guys. And I think a lot through, you really, Clone Wars really touched on that, and I'm so grateful for that series, because there, throughout the, all seven seasons, you see different species on different planets tell Jedi that you're not peacekeepers. You know, you've done nothing but bring war to our planet. We don't care who started it, but you're destroying our home. And you see those things recurring a lot through Rebels and all these other TV shows that we're getting, and I think that's great. But one point I do want to bring up, we were talking about the whole the people who think that Disney's retconning the sequels with Mandalorian. Obviously none of that's true, but what I kind of like about this is that it's creating post-original trilogy content that's more in line with Lucas's vision, I feel like. And I think we're going to get kind of into that Legends territory with the Dark Empire and Thrawn and Luke, and because we've already had both those characters either introduced or mentioned in these live-action shows. So again, not that anything from the sequel is being retconned, but it's kind of creating sequel content for people who may not have been a fan of the sequels, if that makes sense.
Well, that's excellent. I think that's a really good point.
I would say that does make sense, and I like that. You've mentioned that before, I think.
Not that we can't enjoy briefly. All of it, because I do enjoy all of it. I love Star Wars, but...
Right, but there are people who can't stand the sequel trilogy, and it ruined their childhood, and blah, 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 you know, like the whole nine yards. Like,
too bad. Watch it if you don't like
it. Then don't watch it. Well, exactly.
And doesn't the sequel trilogy take place 30 years after the original trilogy? Isn't it a 30-year gap?
Exactly.
So, like, they left that 30 years open for storytelling, and I imagine there's a reason they did that, because that leaves a lot of
Well, I also time think part of with. The reason... I think part of the reason was more practical, because
that too.
It had been some, you know what I mean? Like the de-aging stuff isn't like it is now. I mean, in another year from now, it's going to be a million times better than it is right now. So
for sure,
you know, I don't even think they were thinking about that. I think they just thought, okay, we're going to skip ahead and, you know, like we'll write some books, we'll do some comic books, we'll do all this stuff. And then, you know, Disney Plus comes along and this de-aging comes along and they're like, all right, well, we can have Mark Hamill show up in this show. You know, we can have, and it's really, I don't know. It's just, it's such a great time to be a Star Wars fan, I think.
So I agree. And I think I brought this conversation up to you guys, or I don't know about all of you before, I don't think I've talked about it on the show, but I'm one of the times I met Timothy Zahn a few times at different conventions. And one of the times, the last times I talked to him, it was when the Thrawn Ascendancy trilogy was coming out. And I asked him, I was like, so what are you doing with Thrawn after Jedi? Like, are you writing books about that? Or, you know, what's your plan on that? And he's like, well, that, he's like, I can't talk about it. He's like, that's why I'm writing this prequel trilogy, because they're, you know, Lucasfilm is working on, basically, he said Dave Filoni is working, you know, that's their thing. They're working on it. And so that's why I'm focusing on this time period. But he kind of like had a smile on his face. Like, nice. He's like, basically, he's like, there's something coming. He's like, you right. know, there's all that time period. He's like, but I can't, you know, that's not where they want me to focus on writing right now. Because they wanted, obviously, to tell that story in live action as part of, like, the, you know, like the Legends universe, where it was, you know, this post-Return of the Jedi landscape that we get to, you know, explore for years. And obviously they're going to do most of it on live action right now, which is pretty cool. Like, I would, if I had the choice, I love the Thrawn books, but I would rather see post-Return of the Jedi Thrawn all on TV and, you know, get a ton of movies or TV on it. And then, I mean, they could fill it in with other books and comics on the side, but
I think we might see some of that in the Ahsoka series. And who knows, beyond that, we might even get more supplemental material for Thrawn in the live action. Who knows? I guess they got to gauge the engagement, if that makes sense, with the audience and with people who are watching, and whether they want to see more of that.
I think it kind of goes back to what we've talked about in other episodes, where I think this is all going to end up, you know, it's all going to end up tying together, you know, like the Moff Gideon Empire remnants, you know, could tie together with everything with Thrawn, which also is possibly going to tie together with what's going on with Skeleton Crew in the Unknown Regions. So I think we're going to see a lot of that kind of play out together, kind of building this, you know, Legends time, you know, the people that love all the old Legends material, like, this is going to kind of rebuild all of that in the post Return of the Jedi era and tie it to the sequel trilogy.
To quote Supreme Leader Snoke, give me everything.
That's a good, segue that I didn't expect you to give me, David.
Oh, thanks.
But, I did want to make a mention of when Dr. Pershing in the episode made the decision, right? They were talking together, him and I believe the character is Aaliyah Kane is who plays, what was her name, Matt?
Aaliyah, yeah.
No, the actress.
Katie O'Brien.
Okay, so she plays Aaliyah Kane, and when he decided to say, hey, I want to go ahead and set up my mobile lab station, right? And then they went to the Star Destroyer on the train and everything. That part right there where he goes to her door and he says, hey, I'm ready to do it, because he's getting kind of fed up with the New Republic and he wants to do good, or what he thinks is good. There was music in the background. I don't know if anybody caught it, but it was a very low, ominous tone, kind of like deep-throated, deep-voiced music, and it reminded me of something, and I'm like, what is that? So the second time I listened to it and watched it, I was like, that's the same kind of music that was played in the opera house in Revenge of the Sith when Palpatine and Anakin are there, and it's kind of that kind of sound, and that was playing while he was talking to her, and it got to a crescendo. They use the same music actually when you walk into Snoke's boudoir in The Last Jedi, when they walk in there, when it's all, you know, the whole red room where Kylo and Rey are in, that's the same kind of music they had in the background. So that tells me there's something going on with Kane, and with she's a very manipulative character. I don't know if you guys thought so, but I really did.
Yeah, I definitely, especially at the end of the episode when she turns the lever to like the more intensity or whatever, like she's not recommissioned or whatever, like she's totally.
Yeah, no, I think she's honestly, here's my thought, and this is one of the last things I'm going to talk about here, but like, I think that she set him up to throw all the other people off her trail. I think that she is somehow in league still with Moff Gideon. She knows what happened to him. She's kind of just playing the rumors like they did when they were sitting around that table drinking the buzz balls, where she's like, I don't really know what happened to him. I don't really want to talk about him or think about him. But I think she's totally playing this, and maybe she's trying to destroy the memories of Dr. Pershing so she could get, you know, whatever she wants out of this. But I think that she's in league still with Moff Gideon. She knows where he is, and she's just playing the part until we actually see what she's actually a part of in this whole series.
100%. That was the last thing I was going to bring up as well, is she definitely knows where Gideon is. He's obviously very much alive, and she's just doing all this to service Gideon in some way.
You could definitely tell through that episode, especially like with her acting, that she is still has that kind of nefarious look to her. Like, you know, that kind of little, I'm pretending to be good, but I'm just putting on a show.
I think she's a great actress. Definitely got that vibe.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I was definitely getting that vibe from her acting. I thought it was tremendous.
She was like giving the little gifts, right? I'm pretty sure she gave him the biscuits, right? I think that's what was verified, because he said he wanted those. She's kind of like playing him like a fiddle. She's getting him to where he feels like he's doing the right thing. And remember those officers that, you know, she kind of turned him in, or I guess betrayed him. Those same officers are in The Last Jedi with that ship that's shown the spotlight on. Remember with the Fathiers in The Last Jedi?
Oh, same ship. They had the same helmets and everything.
It's exactly the same. So again, just another link to the sequel trilogy. Sorry, crybaby fanboys. It's going to happen.
And Kyle.
No, Kyle likes the sequels. He's just not as enthusiastic about it as we are. He's more of the Clone Wars is his forte.
That's true. So what do we think's gonna happen next week? Are we gonna be on Coruscant still? Are we gonna be back on Mando? What do you guys think is gonna happen next week?
I really have no idea. And I was gonna ask Kyle this, because he knows a lot better of all the shots that were in the trailers, but I think now we've seen pretty much every shot that was in the trailers.
Except for that X-Wing pilot.
Okay.
We've seen everything besides... We have to go back to Navarro. Carl Weathers is directing the next episode, so it's kind of obvious.
That makes sense. Other than that, I have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, because we're still missing the Jedi Temple shot, which could be anywhere, honestly. It would have to be this episode, you think, because... we've never gotten trailer footage beyond the first half of the season, but we're still missing a couple of shots of the Mandos jumping and attacking the pirates on Navarro.
And the Order 66 directing the next episode.
I wonder if when they go back to Navarro, if somebody will have found a memory circuit for IG-11.
Yeah, that and Dave Filoni is co-writing the next episode with John. So I'd be surprised if we get a little bit of Navarro and we get that War 66 Fox back.
Anything can happen, folks.
All right, so that's going to wrap it up for our episode tonight. Dennis, go ahead and talk about our social medias.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find us under Jawa Jabber or Jabbering Jawas. You can also send us an email. We actually did get an email from somebody, and we're gonna have to read that on the air on the next episode.
Why didn't you say that?
I forgot until now. It's a fellow podcaster. He's been doing it a lot longer than we have, but he's doing it alone, so he feels like maybe if he comes on, it might kind of spark things, maybe on a special bonus episode. But anyway, if you want to send us an email, it's jabberingjawas@gmail.com. like I said, follow us on social media. If you have any questions, please submit it, make a comment, and we'll read it on the air.
We've got our celebration episodes coming up, because that's about 3 weeks away now. Wow, time is really flying. And speaking of time flying, that's going to do it for tonight. For Kenobi, Matt the Radar Technician, Dennis the Phantom Menace, I am David Wren. Thank you all very much for listening, and may the Force be with you always.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.